Welcome to Alternative Currents. I'm Bella Johnson. Julia Cameron has had a remarkable career helping others uncover their creative potential. Her groundbreaking book, The Artist's Way, gave many of us the tools to explore our own creative voices and gave us the validation we needed to believe we were artists, as well as the permission to create without expectation of results. Julia's new book, Walking in This World, has recently been released by Penguin Putnam. This extension of The Artist's Way is enriched by another decade of Cameron's experience teaching, writing, filmmaking, and making art and music. Author of 17 books, fiction and nonfiction, and with numerous credits in theater, film, and television, I am pleased to welcome Julia Cameron to our show today.
Hi, Bella. It's good to be here.
Thank you so much for coming on the air with me today. Julia, you've probably been asked this question hundreds of times, but what inspired you to create The Artist's Way, which has been such a help to so many of us?
I think that that's a question that has a two-part answer. Part number one was that I never expected to write that book. The way that I began teaching The Artist's Way was that I was walking one afternoon in the late fall in New York in West Greenwich Village, and I was praying, sort of asking the God of inspiration for what I should do next, thinking that the answer would be perhaps another movie. And I heard very clearly, you should teach. And I went home and called a girlfriend of mine and said, I don't believe this. I've been praying for guidance about my own work, and I've been told to teach. And she said, well, I'll call you back. And she did, and she said, okay, you have a classroom. You're on the faculty of the New York Feminist Art Institute, and your first class is next Thursday. So, in a sense, I started teaching because I got marching orders that told me to. By that point, I had already been teaching on a private level. I come from a big family, and when you do come from a big family, the minute you learn something, you have to teach your siblings. So it's sort of like, now I can tie my shoes. Teach your sister Libby how to tie her shoes. And I think it was the same sort of impulse that led me into teaching. I've been an artist since I was 18 years old, and inevitably, when you're working in the arts, you run into your own resistance and your own blocks, and you need to devise ways to get through it. And so as soon as I would learn a tool, I would call my sister Libby, who was a painter, or my friend Ed, who was a writer, and I would say, try this. It might work for you, too.
So how do you define an artist, really, in your work? Because it's a pretty broad definition. I know I never thought of myself as an artist, even though I actually can do things like portraiture art, but it's not my profession, you know? So it was really helpful for me to be affirmed as an artist, even though I didn't do it for money.
Well, I think we live in a culture where cash is the affirmation. We live in a culture that says, are you getting paid to do this? If you are, then you're a professional and you're real. And if you're doing something simply for love, then you're an amateur and an imposter. And I think that this is a very narrow way to think about creativity. I believe that we are all creative, that being creative is a part of our DNA. It is as normal to be creative as it is, for example, to have blood and bones. It just comes with the animal. And I think that tools that work on declared artists work just as well on non-declared artists. So that the toolkit that I devised to sort of help nurture those people who were right in the trenches actually translated just fine to work for lawyers and judges and housewives. It wasn't necessarily my intention. I really thought I was writing to a small handful of artists, trying to cheer on the people that I knew personally. But it turns out that when you write very clearly to one person, you communicate very clearly to more than one person.
Well, you mentioned things that, well, certainly occupations that we don't think of as artistic. My daughter, for instance, is very artistic, I would call her an artist.
Uh-huh.
And yet she's really getting into business and law and these kind of things. And it's I have to just let her do that. I have to just let her go to that and know that she'll bring her creativity to that. Can you speak a little bit more to that kind of challenge or affirm that kind of choice?
Well, I think that each life is filled with many tiny choice points. And they are, what am I going to wear today? What kind of curtains am I going to have in the kitchen? What am I going to cook for dinner? Where am I going to go on vacation? How am I going to handle the mess at the office? What kind of car should I buy? Am I going to get a new winter coat? All of these choices are creative choices, even though we don't normally think of them that way. And so I have found that when lawyers, for example, work with morning pages, which are the basic tool of a creative recovery. It's 3 pages of longhand morning writing done first thing when you wake up. I have had lawyers say to me, Julia, I am so much better in the courtroom. I can really think more clearly on my feet. So I think that that all of us can come to exercise our creativity more fully than we do. And we are often unconsciously setting a much lower ceiling than we need to on our creativity. We say, I'm just a business person, when the truth is we may have many gifts that don't quite fit into that category. But it's good to be creative both in business and outside of business.
Yeah, it seems the world would be a better place if everybody was, wouldn't it? Did you, as I recall reading The Artist's Way, I've got it at home, I've got Walking in This World on my lap right now, but did you purposely kind of put the 12 steps to creativity as a kind of a throwback to the 12-step recovery? You talk about artist recovery. Was that a thing that you did on purpose?
This is a great question, actually, because I had taught probably 12 years before I wrote The Artist's Way. So I had a lot of teaching experience, and what I found was that it usually took 12 weeks for a class to gel and get really solid in new creative habits. So that's why it's a 12-week course and not a 10-week course or a 14-week course. It was literally my experience as a teacher, but it is interesting. I have since learned that 90 days is the amount of time that it neurologically takes to groove a new habit. So I think that a lot of 12-step groups, which will say go to 90 meetings in 90 days when someone is first recovering from alcoholism, they are intuitively hooking into something that does have a neurological basis.
Well, it's interesting, too, 12 being one of those divine numbers or mystical numbers. You said
that's
you
right.
Yeah, you taught 12 years, and then it was 12 weeks. I just found that interesting.
And it's been, I think, another 12 years until Walking in This World. I wrote The Artist's Way in 1990. I think it was issued in 92. And then I was working in Walking in This World in 2002. So that's another 12-year cycle.
Now, you mentioned morning pages, which is one of the tools in your artist toolbox, and the artist date. It would be nice to touch on that for people who haven't or are not familiar with it, haven't heard of it. But I noticed the one tool you added to the artist's way creative process is the walk in nature. Mm-hmm. In your introduction, you compare this to the process of taking life one step at a time. There's another AA saying for you. I know that, like you, my most inspired ideas come when walking, usually after I've let my mind run on as long as it wants to, and it begins to slow down so I can receive guidance more clearly. Can you comment further on this, your own process with that?
Well, first of all, I came to walking, I think, the same way that a lot of us do, which is that it was an intuitive response to a life situation. A lot of times when I teach, I will say, how many people intuitively walk when they're trying to decide if they're going to get married? And the hands will go up. When they're trying to decide if they should get divorced? And the hands will go up. When they're trying to decide if they should change jobs or apartments? people intuitively know what's healthy for them. And I think that my tools in this sense are a sort of reminder. Morning pages, I will often have people say, gee, I went through a period in my life when I was writing, but I never added it up that that was what was making me more creative. Or artist dates, which are a once-a-week sort of festive solo expedition. Again, people will say to me, you know, I went through a period where I was exploring my city, and it really did make me feel better. But again, they didn't necessarily add those tools up into a cohesive whole.
Right.
And for myself, I started really walking probably about 12 years ago. And again, the catalyst for me was I was going through grief. My father was dying. I was entering a divorce. It was a very tough period. And I intuitively began to walk to sort of soothe myself. And because I felt baffled and overwhelmed, I would pray as I walked, you know, oh, dear God, help me sort this out. And what I found was that as I walked, solutions came to me, that I sort of set out on the walk with problems, but I tended to come home with solutions. So I began to explore walking as a tool for myself and other people, and I learned that there's actually a pretty extensive literature about walking. I think we all know that Native Americans go on vision quests, walk out into the wilderness alone, and wait to have a spiritual awakening. And we know that Aborigines go on walkabout, which is, you know, a two-week-long trek through the wilderness. But I don't think that we add up necessarily that the English lake poets, who were wonderful poets, were also terrific walkers. There's a great quote from St. Augustine. It's salvitur ambulando, which literally translates, it is solved by walking. And I don't think that the it matters. I think it can be anything from a relationship problem to a plot line. But as we walk, it's as though we're tapping into a deeper body of knowledge. I mean, we use that phrase, body of knowledge, without recognizing that it's a literal phrase, that our bodies do carry a primal level of wisdom that we can tap into when we get out of our heads. But I think in modern life, and this is probably also thanks a lot to psychotherapy, we tend to think of the head as the center of the creative being. And the truth is, it's probably actually the heart that helps us to create. And we often are listening to what you might want to call a negative chatterbox. The head gives us a negative voiceover that we have to get past and through in order to create.
So do you find that walking in this kind of grounding process actually almost literally help your feet know what way to go?
Yes, I think that when we walk, we solve problems. I think that when we walk, we get new directions. I was 46, and I was out on a walk, and I was listening to a tape by a composer named Tim Weider, and all of a sudden, I heard myself say to myself, well, his music's just like your music, but it's inside out. And then my head clicked in and said, you don't have any music. You're not musical. And I've learned to listen to the deeper message. So I started trying to write music, and I've been writing music nonstop ever since. And that was a gift I did not know I had until I started walking, and the walk suggested that I try it. So that to me seems like a pretty big proof.
Yeah. Yeah, I think most highly creative people are creative in many different areas.
I think that's true, and I also think this is something that Europe is much more comfortable with than we are. A British writer might work in any number of fields, might be a playwright, a screenwriter, a novelist, an essayist, and nobody would say, oh, you're a dilettante. But I think in America, and possibly this is because we have the assembly line, so it's like Joe does the lug bolt, that we have a tendency to call ourselves dilettantes whenever our creative curiosity sort of strays over into an unclaimed territory for ourselves.
Well, you also talk in your book about what you call containment, and I've had to learn to live with this because as a highly creative person, it's really frustrating to come up with this constant stream of ideas, and you mention it to the wrong people, and boy, they can really throw a bucket of water on that for you. I think people are afraid of people like us.
Okay, I think this is a very good point. I think that when you begin to recover your creativity, and when I say recover, I mean literally recover the ground that you have drifted away from your authentic self. When you begin to recover your power, it makes the people around you a little bit nervous. They were used to having you be a different way. And I think if we just start blurting out willy-nilly, I'm writing a novel, here's what the novel's about, here's what I'm worried about the plot, here's what I... What happens is the part of you that creates doesn't necessarily know that you're talking instead of writing. And it can... Then when you go back to the page, what you're trying to write can feel very stale. So that's one reason for containment. A second reason for containment, as you brought up, is that you start to run into people that I call wet blanket matadors. And a wet blanket, you'll say, I've decided to go north. And they'll say, well, south is really the only way to go. And you meet with cold water and contradiction. And often, if you can practice enough containment to protect an idea longer, then when you come up with a finished idea, it's much more persuasive to people. And they go, oh, I see. Whereas prior to that, they would be arguing.
Yeah, I think some of that comes with maturity too, don't you? Just the ability to hold that energy, to ground it in, to develop your idea before you kind of throw it out there.
I think we do, as we age, hopefully, learn to be a little bit more patient and also a little bit more shrewd. I think when we're younger, we're idealistic and we think all of our friends should be with us on everything. And I think as we get older, we recognize that some of our friends only like us when we're big. And some of our friends only like us when we're small. And if you go to a friend who likes you big when you're in a scared mood, you're not going to meet a very good reception. And if you go to a friend who likes you small when you're in a big mood, you're not going to meet a very good reception.
Right.
So I think we start to get smarter about choosing our creative companions.
Yep, I agree. Well, we're talking about kind of a support system in a sense with supportive friends. And how important do you feel it is to have a supportive environment for our work, our play for that matter, where we travel, how we move about in the world?
Okay, I think this is a tricky question. I think that the first and most important forms of support have to do with we support ourselves and we believe that there is a power in the universe that also supports us. So in the artist's way, the toolkit is aimed at creating autonomy and a sense of I can do this, you know, the great creator and I working together can do this.
Right.
Then I think as we get further along, we need encouragement, and we don't necessarily need it just plain from God or from an inner sense of determination. We also need outer support. And this is what I meant when I said it was tricky. We can block ourselves all over again if we just start complaining about how they don't understand us and they never do it right, because then we put the focus on other people too much. So it's a balancing act between how much I must support myself and how much I can expect other people to support me. I also hope that what I did with Walking in This World was begin to decipher for people the needs of a creative temperament, because I think sometimes artists intuitively know we need something and we're afraid to ask for it because we don't want to seem self-centered. You know, we've all heard too many stories of Zelda Fitzgerald and Anne Sexton for us to want to be a diva. On the other hand, there are phases in projects where we really need a lot of creative energy, and we need our families and friends to sort of back off and support us from a distance while we focus. This is what I call the glass mountain phase of a project. It's when a project is either going to come together or it's not, and you really have to concentrate. And I think it's helpful just to be able to point to the book and say, well, see right here, it says I'm in the glass mountain phase. I'll be back.
Yeah. I think something has changed, too, almost in an evolutionary sense, though I don't mean that in a Darwinian way, but that the lone artist that used to be able to just kind of sit and create and not really have to worry about being in the world because the community kind of took care of them and so on. It just seems like in current times, we're meant to do more than one thing. We're meant to walk out into the world as well as walk in the world.
Well, I think that we have a peculiar mythology about artists. I think we have a mythology that tells us that artists work alone. Artists are alone with their work. A lot of times I'll discover that a very big block for people is that they're afraid that if they commit to their art, they're never going to have an intimate relationship. And I think if we accurately look at artists, it's as you said, artists used to be more embedded in community. If you look at the Impressionists, they painted lunch with each other. Artists had friends. You know, Puccini walked down a crowded street. He didn't exist in a vacuum. And I think that what we're trying to do is to create a personal environment that isn't toxic to our creativity. And this means that we need to find just a few people who can be for us what I call believing mirrors and catcher's mitts. And these are, it's a very intimate circle. You really only need one, but you probably do need to find that one. And I think it helps to know what we're looking for. Sometimes we think wrongly that what we need to find is a good critic. My experience is we can find critics in profusion. What we actually may need more is a good cheering section first.
How important is it to realize, and part of my question that I probably didn't articulate clearly, how important do you feel it is to realize that we need to move our creations out into the world, that we need to share those, and whatever that means, whether that means taking the day job, as you spoke about in the book, or just being more creative as far as doing more than one thing, you know, how important do you feel it is to actually move that out into the world?
Well, I think it's kind of a two-beat process, Bella. I think the first beat is probably it's important to make things and to create. So first of all, it's let's do something. And then the second beat is let's do something about the something that we've done. And that's the point at which you find artists really want and need an audience. And at first, it may only be an audience of one. But that audience can often help you take the next step. A lot of times, what moves people to center stage as artists isn't exactly talent. It's more their ego strength and their ability to take rejection.
Yes.
And so a lot of what we're trying to teach when we're unblocking people is how do you become resilient enough to sustain an injury and move past it? I'll give you an example. A good friend of mine just wrote a very good book. She turned it in, and her editor called her up and said, "This is the worst book I've ever read. We were all laughing at it when I got it." And my friend has written 5 books, so she wasn't really too badly thrown by this. I think the truth is she was starting to cry, but what she was doing, at least over the telephone, was saying, "I don't think that's accurate. Let me draw a line here. I don't think that's accurate." And then when she got off the phone from that editor, she phoned up the editor's boss and said, "I have just had a very destructive interaction. What are you going to do about it?"
Wow.
And I think learning to take actions in our own defense is sort of part of what you learn in round 2 of being an artist.
Which is?
Well, hopefully, this is what the Walking in This World book is trying to address. It's the issue, essentially, we've all got the same issues. I don't think I have enough money to be an artist. I don't think I have enough time to be an artist. I don't think I have enough solitude to be an artist. I'm not sure I have enough resiliency to be an artist. So all of the essays and tools in Walking in This World are aimed at sort of pragmatically helping people to find more time, helping people to find more solid friendships so they have more resiliency. I do think that I probably wasn't smart enough. I think on a publishing level, 10 years ago, it would have been wonderful to have come out with Artist's Way Round 2 immediately. But I needed to learn a lot more as an artist and as an observer of artists to be able to articulate what we needed second. And hopefully Walking in This World is sort of the distillate of another 12 years of thinking.
Oh, it clearly, to me, it feels much wiser, even though the Artist's Way was so profound and remains so, it definitely does reflect that extra time that it took.
Yeah, I think I've gotten a little tougher and a little shrewder.
Mm.
You know, I'm 54, so I've been writing full-time for 36 years, and just the process that I've been through as an artist myself, you know, since I published The Artist's Way, I've written 4 more plays, 2 more musicals, 3 more novels, a collection of short stories, and every bit of that kind of personal track teaches me something to teach to other people.
Right.
I like to think of myself not so much as a creativity guru, although I have to say, recently I was accused of being the Martha Stewart of creativity.
Oh, no.
I think that was intended to be quite mean. But I do think that I am the floor sample of the toolkit that I teach. And so...
Yeah, you walk your talk.
Well, and also what I learn, I use.
Mm.
And I think maybe why people trust my tools is because they come out of experience instead of out of theory.
Sure. Yeah, sure. I think it's time to take a break, Julie, if you don't mind, and do a little station ID. We are speaking with Julia Cameron today on Alternative Currents. You're listening to WERU-FM 89.9 Blue Hill and 102.9 Bangor. We'll be back in a couple minutes.
Looking out on the endless sidewalks and streets all drenched with rain. All the eyes are filled with teardrops and faces etched in pain. Dreams are built and shattered by a hungry, fitful mind. All All the questions lie unanswered in love we cannot find. You are an endless flame that burns from deep inside me. When I call you by your name, I feel you there to guide me.
A little Eliza Gilkison for you. One of the reasons I like that song is because it puts us in touch with something greater, and I don't want to go too much further in the interview, Julia, but without speaking about the importance of paying homage to the creative source from which all things come to us. Mm-hmm. I know you are a fan of that, and would like you just to comment on that a little bit.
Well, I think that we have a mythology that says that creativity is an act of the ego. And so we're always worried about, am I being too big for my britches? And I think the actual question is a little bit different. The actual question is, what if I'm good, and in this lifetime I didn't have the faith to pursue my dreams? And I think creativity is an act of faith. I think it takes courage to leap onto the blank page or the blank canvas or onto the stage. And I think that we use the phrase the great creator or the creator to talk about God, but we seldom acknowledge that that's literally another term for artist, and that another way to think of God is as the great artist.
Creator.
Mm-hmm. And what I have found is that when we consciously invite this larger creative force into our life to work through us, we begin to have really miraculous results. And I think that I don't really distinguish between creativity and spirituality. I believe that creativity is a spiritual path.
In action.
In action. I also think it teaches us the same kinds of lessons as any other spiritual path. For example, I told the story before about my friend getting attacked about her book. Well, that teaches patience. It teaches resilience. It certainly teaches humility. And just the act of showing up to make our art is a little bit like going to the chapel every day if you're in the monastery. You know, you show up sort of to be of service to a larger something that would move through you.
Right. Again, I want to remind listeners, we are speaking with Julia Cameron, author of The Artist's Way, but currently her new release book, Walking in This World, The Practical Art of Creativity, which is published by Penguin Putnam. You should be able to get those in your local bookstores. I love your statement that artists can waste time and energy mulling the dignity of their acquired position in the field when the truth is they just need to start again.
Right.
I like that quote. I think one of the hardest things is just to take action and do it, just to take that creative piece, that connection with creator, if you will, and express it. I mean, it's one thing to stay inside the chapel and pray and ask and kind of wait for something that may or may not come to you in the way that you expect, but another thing to just do it.
Well, I think that... What you learn as an artist is that the act of making art is what gives you inspiration. And we kind of have that wired backwards. For example, as writers, we think, well, I'll wait to be inspired and then I'll write. But what you learn by actually doing it is that as you write, you become inspired. In other words, the initiative starts with us. It's like throwing a switch. And when we initiate a creative action, then we establish the support. A lot of times we look for the support before we take the action. So we're sort of on the diving board saying, prove to me this will be worth it, and then I'll jump. A good example for this recently for me is that while I was on book tour, before I went out on book tour, which I just came home from, I sat down and read Walking in This World cover to cover just to make certain I knew exactly where I stood on it. And immediately I started writing a novel. So I thought, hey, this book might work. And while I was out on book tour, I wrote a longhand, the first draft of a novel. And this is an example of where you can get hung up in thinking, well, what are the odds of this being bought? What are the odds of my being able to publish this? And the answer, of course, is the odds are much higher, Julia, if you write the book.
Oh, yeah. It's funny. I've got a friend who's hears songs in her head all the time, hears music in her head all the time, but she doesn't know how to annotate music and doesn't know how to play any instrument. And finally decided just to sing the music into a recorder and do something with it. Meanwhile, her husband the whole time is saying, you know, you're never going to make any money at this. I don't even hear you sing. Where are you going with this? What are you doing with this? I think that's fairly common. And she's really had to struggle just to come out of her own fear about that and just do it because it does need to be born. And she finally settled for, you know, the end result that it may only go to her grandchildren, but that it was something that she just needed to do.
Well, one of the things about art is that we can't really tell what the destiny is going to be of each piece of art. I remember when I wrote The Artist's Way, I was a Hollywood screenwriter, and I showed the book to my agent. And my agent was like, Julia, who is ever going to be interested by this? Get a grip. You're a Hollywood screenwriter. Be a Hollywood screenwriter.
Yeah.
And, of course, now it turns out that more than 2 million people have used that book. And if I had listened to the agent, I would never have tried to publish it.
Right.
So I think success is only successful in hindsight.
Well, life is best lived. If we're living out of fear of insecurity, it's best lived in hindsight, and that's no way, you know, we just can't do that, so... You mentioned artists as being very dramatic. We're talking about the screen, and, you know, I certainly know people that are this way as a way to avoid creating, actually, the drama queens out there, and how helpful it is to get out and just move in nature and get grounded and back in the body. Can you talk about that?
Well, I feel like this is probably the chapter I'm going to get into trouble for, because what I say is that artists are dramatic, and that when our imagination isn't yoked to a particular task, it tends to create drama where there isn't any. For example, in our relationships, in our jobs, and the minute we start actually working on a project, everything else sort of mysteriously clears up. And so over the years, and I should say, right now the man I like is a marvelous artist. However, he's a pianist. I can tell when he's not playing the piano enough. He gets a little dramatic. And he will say things to me like, "Have you written lately?"
Oh, yeah.
You know, because when I'm not writing, I'm not as happy. I'm more dramatic. I tend to worry about things more. When I'm actually working, when I'm making art, I tend to have an optimism. I tend to believe things are going to work out. When I'm not making art, I tend to fear that things won't work out. And again, it's all imagination. It's just negative use of imagination or positive use. And I would even say, and again, this is something that I wrote about, that if you have a gift for worry, it probably means you have a very powerful, unused imagination. So sometimes my most negative, cranky, worried, restless, neurotic, etc. Students are actually the ones where you feel like, boy, there's going to be pay dirt when they settle down and start working.
You're absolutely right. I mean, I have personal experience with this. I live with an artist, and you know, I'm certainly an artist in your definition of the word. And I mean, when you say this part of your book may get you in trouble, I can only say it will get you in trouble with people who don't want to admit that about themselves. But the times that we have conflict is exactly that, when, you know, he's frustrated creatively or I'm frustrated creatively, and heaven help us when we're both that way. So it's I've definitely had personal experience with it. You've hit the nail on the head with that one. Yes. I also like your comments on anger. Mm-hmm. When you say it's a signal that we've changed size and must now act larger. This is, anger is so rampant in this world, and it's just the most amazing thing. If you could really trace the non-productive creative juices flowing through these angry people, I bet it would be really something to see.
I agree. I think anger is very useful. I think it's a pretty clear message. I think when we get offended, it sometimes isn't because we're touchy. It's because something really is inappropriate. And we have inadvertently given people permission to treat us badly because we haven't been clear about how worthy we actually are. And once we start to catch on to this, we start saying, "Hey, wait a minute. You can't do that. That's not appropriate." Or as my girlfriend with the book said, "That's not accurate."
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's a crone speaking, because those kind of boundaries, I find, are something that we just learn through hard personal work on some level.
Well, I also think morning pages really help people to intuitively set boundaries. I think that after even 3 or 4 weeks of doing them, we start to say, "No, that's not okay," when we're getting violated on something. I often think it's kind of hard when you have assertiveness training, and it's like, how would a woman with any self-respect act that way? And it's sort of, it's literally acting because you don't have the self-respect. I think morning pages actually give you the inner respect so that you automatically start acting more appropriately to your own worth.
And then when you go out and walk that, you're literally walking that, mm-hmm. It seems to me. I also like your thoughts on energy debts. I think especially with highly creative people, we tend to be more sensitive and need to honor that sensitivity through establishing, again, the healthy boundaries. Can you explain your energy debts a little bit?
Well, this is, again, one of the pieces of observation in walking in this world that I probably wasn't as clear on earlier in my career, but I now believe that there are people that we can invest in and people that we shouldn't invest in. And the people we can invest in are the people who give us a reciprocal return. Then I think there are those people who are sort of bottomless pits and always want us to give more. And I think that as creative beings, we have a lot of what I might want to call life force. We've got a lot of energy. We also, artists tend to be very generous. And so one of the things that happens is that as we sort of amp up and become more powerful, we attract people who want to use our power for their own.
Yeah, you spoke beautifully about that in your book, by the way.
Thank you.
You can go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, I just think we need to think about our, this sounds a little cold, but we need to think about our relationships almost the same way you would think about investments. You know, does my relationship in Susan pay off or not?
Right.
Is this reciprocal?
Yeah.
Is Susan generous back to me or not? And if the answer is no, then we need to move away from Susan.
You know, this is all true. And then there's this thing called distractions. You know, we have so much energy. Creative people have so much energy. And it's really easy to sidetrack that into someone who will take it from you. And there's always someone who will. Even housework. I've been known to do lots and lots of housework when I have a lot of that frustrated creative energy moving mm-hmm. out there. So I do think that it's easy to distract it.
Well, this is something else I want to talk about. I think that probably 10 or 12 years ago, I would have said that artists could get exhausted from making art. Now, I still think that's possible, but I don't think it's very probable. I actually think that what exhausts artists is not making art.
Yeah, I agree.
I think that artists have to really strategize about how to cope with the modern world. One of the things we need for art is the ability to hear our own thoughts. And if our thoughts are constantly interrupted or redirected by radio, television, cell phones, I think cell phones are a clear and present danger for artists. I think that we don't create in a vacuum, but we do need to find some way to set the valve on how much inflow we get. For an artist, it's not the outflow that's exhausting, it's the inflow.
Right. Well, there's also, yes, and I agree, there's also the boundary around how much energy we can channel through from that divine source, the creator in that sense, before we burn out. So I like your quote as well. I've got these little, you know, asterisks in your book, like quote, quote, quote. And one of those is even God rested.
Uh-huh.
Because, in fact, we do need to be mindful of that, don't you feel?
Well, I think it's very interesting. I think artists tend to be hyperactive. And I think when we are able to rest, and this is, again, why walking works for us. Walking is sort of resting in motion. And the minute we start to rest, the well begins to fill back up again, and we start to get new ideas. I sometimes think it would be a great idea if artists took one day a month and stayed in bed just to see what occurred to them. And I think we need to learn to build these kind of miniature rests into our week. I think the artist state, although it's active, is also a form of resting because it's not goal-oriented. It's an activity that's being done sheerly for pleasure.
Yeah, so you can take in from yourself, from your interaction on your date.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I've got to ask you this question. And you did address this in your book about becoming teachable, but what about the frustration of seeing something so clearly in one's inner eye and not being able to commit it to page? Is that all about just getting instruction on how to do that? Or, you know, whether it's something you're drawing or writing or whatever it is, I don't have any problem with the writing end of it. It's more the drawing part of it.
Okay, I think you're asking a delicate question. First of all, I think we will always see things more clearly and more magically than we are perhaps able to execute them. I think that's sort of the carrot that leads the artist on, that we are striving to capture this perfect something that we've seen. But I also think that even though I have probably seen more good artists and writers, certainly damaged by bad teachers than helped by good teachers, there still comes a point where you need to ask, can I get some help with this that would be useful to me? And then you need to sort out whether the person who is presented to you as an expert actually is an expert or is what I call an amateur expert. An amateur expert is somebody who is posing to have expertise in your area, but they probably don't really have any seat-of-the-pants expertise.
Right.
So I think it behooves us to remain teachable, but it also behooves us to be skeptical about exactly who is qualified to be a teacher.
Right. Well, we're running into the end of this hour, and so I'd love it for you to contribute anything you feel is left somehow unsaid, and also just to touch upon how art can lead to that greater sense of personal authenticity, because you do touch on it in the book. And again, let me just remind listeners, we are speaking with Julia Cameron, author of The Artist's Way, more currently her new book, Walking in This World.
Well, I, at the risk of beating a dead horse, I want to say that it's pretty simple to assemble a radio kit that's going to help you with your authenticity. And that would be the three basic tools. Get up in the morning and write 3 pages daily of just how you feel and how you think and where you are. Once a week, go out and do something festive and interesting by yourself just to entice what you might want to call your inner explorer. And once a week or more, get out for a walk and get into your body and see if you can get in touch with how you really feel and how you really think. And those three tools used together are a pretty powerful wake-up call.
What do you do about people who just, you know, these steps sound simple, but there are people who just cannot get themselves to do the pages? My partner's one of them. He's just like, I can't do it.
I can't do anything about that.
Yeah, yeah. But isn't that really the first step?
You know, that's where I'm completely powerless. And I have to say these tools are for the people who choose to use them,
right?
Not for the people who ought to use them.
Right. Right. Actually, that's a really good contribution. Well, I tell you, I thank you very much for being with us on Alternative Currents today. And we'll remind people that your latest book, Walking in This World, The Practical Art of Creativity, can be purchased in all local outlets, I would imagine. It's a Penguin Putnam release. Any other contact information, Julia, book signings, anything in the on the Eastern Seaboard that you might want to let people know about?
No, I think I'd love for people to start exploring this book, and I am happy that the Internet is full of Artist Way groups. I'm hoping that some people, and perhaps they will be in the East, would be excited about starting a Walking in This World group and doing that over the Internet.
Great. Thanks again. We appreciate it and feel honored to have you here today.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Take care.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye.